Welcome to Dispatch in Depth, where we give you the stories behind the science of emergency dispatch. This is the official research podcast of the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, the world's leading authority in dispatch science. I'm your host, Isabel Gardette, Director of Academics for the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch. In each episode, we'll be bringing you stories of the fascinating people who do research in this area. We'll give you their backstory, including how they got there, what they're working on, and what drew them to the research. These are people who represent the cutting edge in dispatch research, and I hope you'll join us to hear more about them. Today we have with us Ivan Whitaker, Medical Program Administrator for Priority Dispatch. Welcome, Ivan.
Thank you very much for having me.
Today we're going to talk about a new product that we have available, a new system that we're using, which is medical transfer protocols. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So those protocols were excellent in a landscape where we were having acute illnesses or injuries with patients at a facility. But we needed to enhance our protocol, our transfer protocol suite, to allow us to be able to deal with transfers to where it wasn't an acute illness or injury, where actually patients were being transported for what we call continuation of care. And so these protocols handle the acute illness or injury. It also handles the routine transfer, and it handles the mental health patient as well.
Then what does continuation of care mean? How is that different from an acute injury?
Right. So a continuation of care may be a patient that's at an emergency room or admitted to a facility and they, say, take radiation therapy every week or need dialysis treatment every week. And so these transfers are kind of pre-scheduled. And so that's what Protocol 46 actually handles, those routine transfers.
Before we go on, then, can you give us a sense of what each of the new protocols includes and what each one is designed to handle?
Yes. So Protocol 45 is our UpCare transfer protocol, and it handles acute illnesses and injuries in medical facilities. And when we say medical facilities, we're primarily talking about skilled nursing facilities, assisted living facilities, clinics. These patients may have respiratory distress right now, or these patients may have fallen and they need to be seen at an emergency room. Protocol 46 is for the routine transfers we were just discussing, just continuation of care. And Protocol 47 is your mental health transfer. Maybe you have a patient that's trying to check into a mental health facility, but the facility won't accept them because they need medical clearance. And so they have to go to the hospital to be cleared to receive treatment.
What was the immediate need behind this? Were there calls that we were receiving that weren't being handled on the protocol, or was there a particular agency that called for this? What was the process behind this?
Yes, very good question. This has been a two-year process, and it came about twofold. First, nurses and physicians were complaining that they were answering too many questions and actually needed to get back to the patient because we were not going to provide them with our pre-arrival instructions like CPR. So they really wanted to give us some basic information and just get back to the patient. Another challenge that we had is that we weren't able to really get our resources in the field from our determinant code perspective. We really weren't able to match the resources like we wanted to. And the third issue is what we call our ICD-10 codes, which Medicare, Medicaid, and insurance companies use for billing purposes. So we weren't able to match those really well with protocols 33 and 37. So these three protocols, they do all of that. We can get to all of our transfer or response deployment combinations like critical care resources in the field, ALS versus BLS resources, specialty teams. We can also match our codes, our determinant codes, to the ICD-10 codes, and we can also get the nurse back to the patient as quickly as possible because a lot of our questions are blue for you. And so we're training that if you give us great information in the beginning, you can get back to the patient as quickly as possible.
Okay, that's interesting. Then are these primarily calls that are coming in from skilled professionals, coming in from clinicians?
Yes, very good question. And one of the unique features of this protocol is what we call a healthcare professional is actually user defined. And it's in our special definitions feature in the admin tool where the individual agency is deciding what they view or deem as a person or skill level that can make the decision or in these calls that we're recognizing that they're giving us good information. We recognize that information.
And what are some of the types of people who are being designated? included?
RNs, registered nurses, LPNs, physician assistants, paramedics, social workers, and even in some environments, CNAs, depending upon the type of facility.
And does that only count if they're calling in from their facility? Or what happens if, let's say, a nurse happens to find somebody on the street and calls in and gives information? Is that the same kind of situation, or would you go through the regular MPDS protocol for that?
Yeah, we wouldn't use 45 through 47 for that. One of the main things with these protocols is that we really want the dispatch review and dispatch steering committees to identify those facilities or facility types that actually qualify for the use of this protocol.
Okay.
So the facility is going to drive that more so than an individual nurse that's, say, a registered nurse that is at a personal residence. We will use a regular chief complaint protocol for that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you talked a little bit earlier about the ICD-10 codes, and this might be something that's not real familiar to a lot of people. So the ICD-10 codes are sort of diagnostic codes that the hospitals primarily and other health facilities use to code a diagnosis. So if you have a stroke or if you have a heart attack, there's going to be a particular code that they use for that, and they use it for tracking the patient's care, and they also use it for billing.
Yes.
Does that mean that these transfer protocols, you said they connect up with the ICD-10 codes. Does that mean that they can be used for billing?
Yes. That was one of the main drivers of the development of the protocol. What's happening in the emergency landscape in the field is that they're billing for these transfers based upon the paramedic run report. However, they had to send resources based upon the interrogation of the caller. So it's kind of, in a sense, unfair for them not to be able to bill at the dispatch point based upon the information that they receive, because they cannot forego receiving those resources. So that's why it was critical that we developed something that we could actually assign ICD-10 codes to in the beginning. It actually changed our development process, because when we rolled out the first edition of this, we really only focused on ALS and BLS categories, but we had to go back to the drawing board, because you could have an abdominal pain patient that's ALS, or you can have an abdominal pain patient that's BLS.
And we should just interject here really quick. ALS is advanced life support, which usually means a paramedic.
Yes.
And BLS is basic life support, usually an EMT type level responder, right?
Exactly. And so that billing regimen from trying to just distinguish ALS between BLS wasn't good enough. We had to identify the actual chief complaint of abdominal pain, and if that abdominal pain, what was being stated to us, was an ALS call or a BLS call. And so we're able to do that now. And so there's different ICD-10 codes based on the chief complaint and the medical necessity of the call as well. And we can do that now.
Talk then a little bit more about what's the value there for the agency or for the clinicians or whoever there's value. Why is it useful to be able to code that straight from the dispatch point rather than from the responders?
Right. So we're talking, if we're looking at the billing perspective, we're talking about recoup rates. So any billing department in the emergency setting knows that a lot of times from a Medicare, Medicaid, CMS perspective, they're having to prove several times, they're having to resubmit that the transfer was warranted. And so if you're going to the starting at the dispatch point, we know now that EMS could not forego that transfer. And so being able to assign the ICD-10 code there and show what resources were warranted there based upon what the nurse was requesting or stating, that's pivotal.
That's interesting. So what you're basically saying is that the information gathered at the dispatch point is actually being used to validate that the particular type of response that was sent, the particular type or level of resource that was sent, was valid from a payment perspective.
Yes. And not only validate, but we can do quality improvement, quality assurance, and may need to educate those skilled nursing facilities, assisted living facilities of, hey, this is what we actually need. This is the information, because there's a disparity of what we're hearing at the dispatch point versus the resources that are really needed once we arrive on scene and assess the patient.
To make sure that we're sending the right resource depending on the particular situation.
Exactly.
That's very interesting. So is there anybody who's using these tools already?
Yes. We have about 12 agencies in what we call a pre-release at this time. Those agencies are high performers, and so the majority of them are accredited. And what's distinct about those agencies is they run a high volume of non-emergency transfers.
What's the background for the development of these protocols? Was there any research that went into this development, or what was the process for coming to these particular protocols?
Yes. So we actually had Mark Rector that started a, kind of a similar transfer protocol in a different environment. It's not as robust as what we have today, but basically kind of pushed the need of these protocols. And we started off with a team of about five individuals that basically were heavy hitters in the non-emergency transfer environment. And they discussed some of the challenges that they were having with protocols 33 and 37, like those protocols, but just couldn't get to the combinations for response in the ICD-10 code from a billing perspective. So that was kind of about 2 years ago now, the kind of the starting point of getting this thing moving forward. So it really took off once we developed the first rendition of this and released it, and we moved it into five beta agencies. And those beta agencies really were instrumental in letting us know that we weren't there yet. And so we got back to the drawing board, got valuable information, and moved forward. And so it took off from there.
The development then was more of a, it was consensus driven by people who are in the field who understand the considerations and the problems more so than being research based.
Definitely.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Given then that this was more of a consensus driven process, do you see a place for research in the future to validate what you're doing with these protocols?
Definitely. One of the things that we're doing right now is a benefits analysis. And so that benefits analysis has a bit of research. In that research, we're trying to determine what the recoup rate was at the beginning of the process versus the end of the process. And so we're doing a 2-month beta. And with that beta, we're trying to determine the recoup rate. Were they able to recoup more? Was it less? And we're also doing some research kind of on endpoints, how well we were able to match what we determined it to be or the chief complaints, et cetera, versus what was determined when they arrived on scene at the patient.
One of the things that we find in the research that we do is that the ICD codes, whether it's ICD 9 or 10, depending on what data you're looking at, can be real problematic in terms of understanding exactly what was wrong with the patient. A lot of times, providers will assign a lot of different codes just to try to cover their bases, or they'll try to code higher to get a higher reimbursement rate. Do you perceive any issues in terms of your matchup between the protocol and the ICD-10 codes from that perspective?
There could be if they're not matched accordingly. So one of the things we're going to do is work with billing departments on how to actually match. It's going to be up to those billing departments to match those codes, but the billing departments also need to look at patient outcomes from a emergency room diagnosis perspective as well. So if we don't look at patient outcomes, then we could be missing the bar. Are you looking at patient outcomes when you're doing your studies?
Yeah, in fact, we've used the ICD-10 codes to try to identify what the actual outcome was from a particular dispatch. So if we dispatch something as, say, a heart attack or as a stroke, is that what was actually identified when they got to the hospital? Is that how they were diagnosed? The only issue we've seen, like I was mentioning, was that these ICD-10 codes may or may not be assigned according to the standards that we might use, or they might be given 5 or 6 different diagnostic codes. And so we're trying to figure out what's the primary code and what was the real diagnosis. So I just wondered if you had taken that into consideration.
Yes, and it's definitely going to be a benefit to work with the Academy and the research team to go back and be able to look at how these ICD-10 codes are applied and then look at things from a patient outcome perspective to see if there's a match or a parallel.
If any agencies are listening to this podcast right now, what's their next step? How do they find out more?
Yes. So right now, Darren Judd is our new program administrator. He'll be handling all protocol through 45 through 47 implementations, and he could be reached at Priority Dispatch. Right now, any newcomers, what we're doing is kind of placing them in the queue. We'll do more of an educational session with them to let them know what the protocols are about, and we'll demo the protocols. We're not having any new agencies enter the pre-release stage because we're really trying to close up the benefits analysis as quickly as possible so we can have that vetted data that we can present and move forward with the general release.
And I think I've heard that you can get these protocols separately from the MPDS, or is that not right?
Yeah. Well, we're exploring that right now, and that decision is still out there. What we believe is that actually the non-emergency transfer environment is actually a bigger environment than the 911 environment. And so with that being said, we're looking at a totally different implementation process, which we pretty much developed, even a certification process and an accreditation process for those agencies that would never take a 911 call. So that is in the works at this time.
You're not concerned then that there would be emergency type calls that would come in that might be better handled on the MPDS?
We are concerned. And so that's why we want to get our ducks in a row and make sure we have the best information and we're going through the investigation process before we roll that program out. We want to be sure that in that environment that they would actually never receive a 911 or emergency type call.
If I'm a dispatcher in a, let's say, a 911 center that also has these protocols available, how do I differentiate? How do I identify one of these calls that should be handled on the new transfer protocols as opposed to in the traditional MPDS?
Very good question. One of the things we have to work, or the groups that we have to work closely with inside of the dispatch center, is the dispatch review and dispatch steering committee. The implementation of this without those committees in place, identifying the qualifying facilities, it's probably not going to work as well. And so we want to make sure that we work with an agency. We have a very, I think, a great laid out implementation process. And once we identify those facilities, then those facilities or the facility types, actually, that information is transferred into the comm center in an internal policy. So that's where some of the training takes place, is we're training them on which facilities actually qualify. The good thing is if they forget, we have the ability to input those facilities inside of the protocols, so they actually show up in a drop-down list as well. And so they're going to be trained on the facility type. So some agencies will use these transfers for all skilled nursing facilities. And so if they forget or they don't know if that's a skilled nursing facility, they'll have a drop-down list they can query from to double-check and see if that agency qualifies.
Right. So while I'm using the MPDS, mm-hmm. if I am entering information, say, for about an address or, mm-hmm. or information about a facility, there will be a list available for me to use to identify that as one of the facilities that I can use the transfer protocols for?
Well, there's a twofold process. Again, working in a 911 center, most agencies have trained their dispatchers to call takers to understand the difference between what an assisted living facility, a skilled nursing facility, and then a call from a residence is. And so these are not used for calls from residences or for a call that they would receive from maybe an intersection like a traffic accident. These are strictly from facility types. So once a agency calls in and says, this is Nurse Bill and I'm from Lakeland Regional Medical Center, then we know that that is a healthcare facility. And so that's where we'll go down the interrogation route of trying to determine at that point, is that prudent for 45 through 47? And that's going to be based on the training of knowing the facility types, not so much the individual facility itself, but facility types. And let me go a little bit further with that discussion. The first question we're asking is, was this patient seen by a healthcare professional in the last 2 hours? And so if the answer to that question is no, then we automatically have an option to shunt to a regular chief complaint protocol based upon the answer to that question.
And what happens in that case if the facility or the center doesn't have the MPDS?
So if they're not using MPDS, it would kind of be the environment that they're in right now, where they do have some type of protocol in place or some type of transfer regimen in place that they go down in a triage process. So we shouldn't be using the MPDS, or they shouldn't be receiving calls that would require the MPDS. If they are, then they need the MPDS.
And if they did take one of those calls, they might end up transferring it back to a 911 center if they happen to receive one of those calls.
That's correct. That would be the process.
One more quick thing before we go. One of the things that we are consistently concerned about, I think, is making sure that people are selecting a very specific chief complaint.
Right.
So, for example, we see a lot of use of the sick person protocol to
right.
handle kind of a hodgepodge or a miscellany or different kinds of calls. And we try to move people away to choosing the most specific chief complaint protocol whenever possible. Is there some potential that this 45 to 47 group would become a catch-all for people to go straight to a smaller set of questions rather than using the specific chief complaint?
Yes, that's a wonderful question. One of the things that we need to look at with this protocol is what we call distribution utilization. And so what we want to make sure is that, and I'll give an example, you were talking about Protocol 26, and our accredited agencies, we actually did a study and found that the utilization of Protocol 26 is about 11-13% in that particular protocol in the United States.
And that's the sick person protocol.
That's the sick person protocol, yes. And so we want to make sure that we get a good kind of a utilization feel. And it could be different for agencies. Some agencies may process 80% of their call volume on this particular this particular protocol suite. But we want a kind of a range of where that particular agency should be. And that's why it is critical, it's paramount that each of these agencies have a good sound quality assurance, quality improvement process in place. So we can start looking at these distribution numbers and they know if they're too high or too low, maybe there is some type of chief complaint selection issue.
You'll be evaluating then what level of utilization there should be.
Yes.
And trying to make sure that they're sticking within that same area.
Definitely. And not just by entire protocol suite, but individual protocols 45, 46, and 47. There may be some differences. For example, we know that Protocol 45 will be used vastly more than Protocol 47. So one of the things we want to make sure that we do with these protocols is really involve the field providers. There's a lot of information that we'll be dumping over to CAD. For example, the type of equipment that is required or will be monitored, the type of medications that will be monitored, people that may be accompanying the patient while are doing transport, like family members or a respiratory therapist. And so it's very important that they understand what they'll be able to see in their CAD and also how to retrieve that information or use that information that could be critical during the transport.
So. Okay. Well, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
See you next time for Dispatch In Depth. For more great content, please go rate and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcast.